We have our own homegrown right-wing, far-right authoritarian movements here. What's going on with this trucker convoy? There's sort of the individual level where what the truckers seem to want. And then there's kind of what the organizers behind the scenes and what they want. Everyone just underestimating the funding that's going to these people because of digital media and social media. There is instant access to all sorts of radicalized groups who can mobilize people in an instant.
Welcome to episode 99 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Coco Das, one of those volunteers, guest hosting this week's episode. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. Today's episode is a bit of a departure, as it is all about Canada. Specifically, the convoys of trucks that have held siege over the capital city of Ottawa for 3 weeks now, which some have aptly called the Flu Trucks Clan. As Arwa Madawi wrote for The Guardian, quote, "What's unfolding in Ottawa is not a grassroots protest that has spontaneously erupted out of the frustration of local lorry drivers. Rather, it's an astroturfed movement, one that creates an impression of widespread grassroots support where little exists, funded by a global network of highly organized far-right groups and amplified by Facebook's misinformation machine. The drama may be centered in Canada, but what is unfolding has repercussions for us all," end quote. At its peak, around 400 trucks and 8,000 people took part in these protests, ostensibly against vaccine mandates. But like in the U.S., at its heart, it is dripping with white supremacy and Christian fascism. The Canadian news source CBC reports, quote, "Some protesters say they went to Ottawa on God's instructions. Christian faith, with an overtly evangelical feel, flows like an undercurrent through the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa. While no mainstream Christian organization has thrown its official support behind the Freedom Convoy, some of the funds raised for the cause have been donated through the Give, Send, Go crowdfunding site, which is administered by a Christian group," end quote. Sarah Posner pointed out on Twitter that Jericho marches had started circling the parliamentary precinct every morning. And she wrote, quote, "Recall, Jericho marches were key organizing tools in the run-up to January 6th. Their central claim, Trump was the true victor in the election and God wanted him to retain power," end quote. We'll be linking to some important articles about the Flu Trucks Clan siege in our show notes. Later in this episode, you will hear three voices from the courageous counter-protests that stopped a convoy from passing through one area of Ottawa. But first, here's my interview with Canadian scholar Stephen Mazaros, who has been studying American fascism while following news of these truck convoys on his side of the border. Today, I'm really happy to be speaking with Stephen Mazaros about the anti-vax far-right truck blockades in Ottawa. They've been called by many different names, but I'm really interested in hearing what Stephen has to say about them. Stephen Mazaros is a PhD candidate in the Department of Politics at York University in Toronto. His dissertation research focuses on libertarian individualism and far-right authoritarianism in the United States. He received a master's degree in political science at York University, where he researched alienated labor and the restructuring of work in the U.S. automotive industry. And he completed his BA in political science at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario. I think you may be the first Canadian we've had on the podcast. So welcome, Stephen.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So let's just start with the facts. Can you walk us through the basics of this? Can you walk us through what's happening? Why is it happening? And what are the stakes of this, not just for your country, but globally?
My information from what's going on with this trucker convoy is that there's kind of two things happening. One, there's sort of the individual level where what the truckers seem to want. And then there's kind of what the organizers behind the scenes and what they want. But ultimately, if anyone who went to the Freedom Convoy and talked to the protesters or listened to them, these truckers are basically stating what they mean by freedom. They mean a return to the free market. So free markets are good. Government intervention is bad. Very classic type of mentality for right-wing movements. There's also this idea that individual freedom is about the freedom to do what one wants without consequence or without any repercussions or without any acknowledgement of public health. So for them, individualism is very important in that spec, but it really means about making your own choice without regards to others and other people's freedoms. And obviously, it's been brewing for a long time because of the lockdowns and the vaccine mandates that are being imposed by the Liberal government. For some truckers, they're pretty much against it. Although I would say that a lot of these truckers are vaccinated, at least they claim they are. And the signs typically say that they are vaccinated. This is not about vaccines, that in fact, this is about government overreach. So it's easy to see them as sort of like anti-vaxxers, but I'm not sure if that's the major concern. They're very wary of tyranny. They kind of view the Liberal government of Canada, the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, as a tyrant. He is a dictator. And this type of thinking has been the case for the past few years. Since Trudeau got elected in 2015, there's just been a huge sort of backlash among the right. And so the truckers, they kind of want their voices heard, but they also want to cause disruption for the sake of disruption. The one thing that I noticed is that there's a lot of hatred towards Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, but a lot of the lockdowns have been done in the, you know, wearing masks and stuff like that. It was the conservative government in Ontario that are enforcing these mechanisms. And so I don't see anybody calling for the death of Doug Ford. They are calling for the death of Trudeau. Some of them are. They see Trudeau as a tyrant, but somehow Doug Ford isn't, although there are criticisms of Doug Ford.
Can you explain who Doug Ford is for
those of us? Doug Ford is the premier of Ontario. He's a leader of the Conservative Party. I'm thinking in 2018, he ran a campaign based on a very populist rhetoric. So his campaign was based on, you know, we're going to reduce the price of beer, buck a beer, like a dollar a beer was kind of his idea. And that is a tactic sort of identify with the common person, right? Is to identify with this working class or, you know, lower income people who like to drink beer, right? So we're going to drop it. We're going to bring back dollar a beer and we're going to allow beer to be sold in all sorts of stores. And it was really about those kinds of things. Everything else, things like healthcare, long-term care homes, all those topics were not really much of a concern. So Doug Ford is a populist conservative leader, and he has been. However, I will say since the pandemic, he's been a little bit more cautious. And you can see that in his face when he talks. But again, he refuses to take responsibility for the bigger problems of privatization of our long-term care homes and the lack of funding in healthcare systems that not only his government, but previous governments before have been reducing.
I was struck by something this writer Arwa Madawi wrote for The Guardian about the trucker convoys. And she said, it's not a grassroots movement, but a quote unquote astroturfed movement. It's funded by a global network of highly organized far-right groups and amped up on Facebook and social media. And their agenda is actually not popular in Canada. Even among the cross-border drivers, 90% of them are vaccinated, as you were referring to. It's only a very small percentage of these truckers who have not gotten vaccinated or refused to get vaccinated. The Canadian Truckers Association has disavowed these protests, and 84% of the population, including children in Canada, have received at least one vaccine dose. So, you know, here in the U.S., I'm paraphrasing the revolutionary leader Bob Avakian, who's been studying the American fascist movement for decades, at least going back to the Clinton years. You know, here he says, this shining city on a hill, referring to how Reagan talked about the U.S., this shining city on a hill is full of fascists. I mean, Trump got over 74 million votes. And, you know, even if all of them are not hardcore fascists, Trump has galvanized a fascist movement here. But I don't get the sense that this is true in Canada, but maybe I'm wrong. What do you think this trucker convoy portends about rising right-wing authoritarianism in Canada? And how serious do you think this threat is?
It's a very good question. And this goes back to sort of the first question you asked, where I said, you know, there's an individual level, so sort of what the truckers are saying, and then the actors behind the stage, who's organizing this. And you've pointed out an article that highlights this is kind of a top-down organized and orchestrated event as opposed to a organic grassroots mobilization efforts, which is what a lot of people seem to think. Now, is there a significant threat? In my view, yes, this is very threatening. So this is part of a much bigger problem that we're seeing in Canada. There is a splinter happening within the Conservative Party. So in the Conservative Party, you have this splinter group that created a separate party. So they split from the Conservatives and they're called the People's Party of Canada. This is run by Maxime Bernier. You can easily look up their website to find out exactly what their views are, but they're very much in line with Donald Trump's. They're very much in line with any US far-right authoritarian groups. It's very much a populist ethos, but it's also very much authoritarian. And this splinter is growing. And it's becoming increasingly violent. When I say violent, I don't mean they're tearing things down, but they're causing sabotage. You know, for example, in the last election, I was helping out the Liberal candidate and we received death threats on a frequent basis. It was quite common. And it's pretty clear that the Conservative person who was running and are trying to get the People's Party votes. And so, again, there's this People's Party faction that's growing. And then also the other faction I want to mention is called the Wexit Party. And this is more to do with Western Canada. Mm-hmm. And this deals with people in Alberta, for example, and not necessarily the people there. It's just, it's right to point out it's a small group of people. But I would add a caveat that is for now. There's a strong online presence that we need to start paying attention to. But the Wexit people, they're based on the West Coast, and they have very similar views as the People's Party. Difference is they want to separate and sort of they have enough of Trudeau's tyranny, right? And so these are the actors that are involved behind the scenes that, you know, are getting the support from all right-wingers in the United States.
In pictures that I saw on Twitter, I was following Twitter partly because of the counter protests, which I think were really, really important for the people to actually gather and start pushing back against. Because I think my sense of what was happening was that the authorities, the government did not know how to respond, and that this trucker convoy was just rolling over people and actually harassing residents, right, in downtown areas, causing a lot of noise, a lot of disruption, and really making clear that they were also standing against the people, not just against the government. And the fact that people then decided to take to the streets and actually, you know, put up some resistance, I think it was extremely important. You know, Refuse Fascism started in order to organize this mass mobilization of people who do not want a fascist future. But what do you think accounts for the authorities, from the police to Trudeau, taking such a hands-off approach to this? One thing I saw also was that a lot of these were just pickup trucks. They weren't like commercial trucking vehicles. I don't know if that's just the pictures that I saw. And then today I saw one Twitter thread that said that the truckers were not even issued parking tickets, clearly illegally parked. They were breaking all kinds of laws, but even like the simplest mechanisms were not used to stop them. So I was wondering if you have any comments or insight on what was going on there. Why was there not a response to actually stop it?
It's a very good question. And it's something I ask myself every day. And I'm waiting for Trudeau to do something. This could have been stopped 10 days ago. They had one day to make their statement and go home. But nobody did anything. There was a lack of enforcement. And that signifies to me that this is actually a lot more problematic, in that we saw there was a video that was released of a police officer who stands in solidarity with the truckers. I'm not saying all police officers do, but the thing with these protesters, they are pro-police in many ways, even though they're against a police state. They're very friendly with police authorities. So I suspect not much was done as a result. I mean, if you would compare the response to, let's say, a Black Lives Matter protest in Canada, or let's say when the G7 has a summit in Canada and people go out and protest and it's coming from the left, I mean, they have no problem using tear gas and whatnot to disperse the crowd. But suddenly with this, everyone is sort of held hostage and doesn't know what to do. And there's no one really to blame other than, I think, everyone just underestimating the funding that's going to these people, how long and persistent that they are, and that it's not going away. And the reason why there's a lack of a response is I don't think the liberals or even the conservatives really are taking this as serious as it should be.
Is there anything more you've learned in your research about the convoys that we haven't had a chance to cover? Are there some key players we should be paying attention to? And I also want to ask you about the role of white supremacy. I'm not as familiar with racial politics in Canada. In the US, the white supremacy is one of the key pillars of the fascist movement. And, you know, in relation to the police, January 6th here kind of showed that this fascist movement likes the police when they're cutting down Black people, but when they're trying to stop a coup attempt at the Capitol, then they hate the police. So I think their logic is very much bound up with who they see as human and subhuman. This is one of the reasons why we say this is a fascist movement. From my reading, it does seem like there's a white supremacist aspect to it in Canada as well. And that also sort of defines how they approach talking about the police. They don't want a police state, yes, not against them, but, you know, against Indigenous protesters, sure. So I wanted to give you a chance to just share any other like aspects of this that we might be missing.
So, yeah, I think it would be a mistake to say that this is this convoy and sort of Canadian fascism or right-wing authoritarianism is a byproduct of the United States. I think that's a bit simplistic. We have our own homegrown right-wing, far-right authoritarian movements here. I am not an expert on them. I mean, my focus is more on the US, but I can say that I noticed a lot of resistance starting with the refugee crisis that was happening way back in like 2015, 2014, you know, what was happening in Europe and all those refugees coming, and Trudeau was wanting to have refugees in. I mean, there was a huge backlash to that. And of course, it goes farther than that. But what I can say is that it is homegrown. It is not just because the US is pushing the Canadian to become far right. It is completely brought upon by the People's Party of Canada, which is a splinter group of the Conservative Party. And it's brought by the Wexit Party, that is a Western separatist party, who are very much in line with white nationalist views. The one thing I want to say, just as sort of a piece of information, just to know how serious I think this is that Kevin O'Toole was the leader of the Conservative Party until recently. And during the last election, back in September, Kevin O'Toole, this is a federal election, I should say, Kevin O'Toole ran as quite the moderate, actually. No, there was this idea that he wanted to reach across the aisle. Climate change is real. For a lot of conservatives, that's a huge far left idea now in Canada. Like, just very fascinating to see that become politicized. But yeah, so he tried to reach across the aisle and presented himself as very ambiguous and open to ideas, I guess, and open to conversation. But he was punished severely. And what I mean by that is that he got removed. So the party itself will determine the leader, because we have a parliamentary system. So the Conservative Party, they're having a race. If they might have already chosen one, I don't know. But last I checked, Kevin O'Toole is stepping down. And he was only leader for one brief period of time. And the second he said something about climate change, people got really upset. So no, it's grown here. And I think it's a product of, we also have a colonial past with our Indigenous populations. And then, of course, there is a reactionary response to Trudeau, for sure. Yeah.
So I wanted to shift gears a little as we wind down. I'm really interested in what's stated in your bio about your research, including into libertarian individualism. I think that this analysis of individualism, an individualism that, you know, in my opinion, is just off the rails, and these twisted ideas of what freedom is to these people, I think that's a really important aspect. And I know this is in relation to American politics, but can you just talk a little bit more about that? What are some things that you've discovered about these links?
Before I even address that question, I just want to state, yeah, we could talk about Canada, US, and of course, my dissertation is on the US, but this is really quite a global phenomenon. Because of digital media and social media, there is instant access to all sorts of radicalized groups who can mobilize people in an instant. This is far different. So I do want to add that as sort of a qualifier. We need to start paying attention to what's happening on social media, and we shouldn't be surprised that this is spreading across the globe so quickly. And just one last thing I want to say about this global phenomenon, this is why many far-right people are pushing for these freedom convoys to start happening all over the place, because this is the unifying banner that can bring together this divergent far-right group. Because the far-right is very divergent. That's the one thing that people need to understand, is that Ben Shapiro is not the same as Richard Spencer, who's, you know, obviously in hiding right now. Alex Jones is not the same as Rand Paul, for example. There are differences. A lot of them don't like each other. Mm-hmm. So there's a desperate need for unity. And one of the things they can unite under is freedom. And of course, we know this historically. A lot of authoritarian leaders and mobilization efforts use the terms like freedom. And so individualism and libertarian individualism, I feel, is a way to mobilize people to think that they have a right to do what they want and be left alone from government, which is a very traditional libertarian argument. If you talk to most libertarians, they would say, we just want to be left alone. You do what you want, I do what I want. But we're seeing kind of a change. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the context of the American right, and even in Canada, the Canadian right, it's changing towards more authoritarianism. Yeah. And within that context, individualism now means something else. It doesn't just mean I want to be left alone by the government and be self-sufficient, you know, those survivalists. Now it's not only do I want to be left alone, but I want to have the right to cause hate and violence towards what I deem as threats, such as immigrants, for example. Mm-hmm. I want the right to spread an infectious virus without any consequence whatsoever. A classic quote I'll just say, it's like, you know, the Tea Party quotes, like, don't tread on me. Well, that's a traditional libertarian argument, but that's no longer the case. In my view, what we're seeing is that under an authoritarian right-wing context, libertarianism means don't tread on me and I will tread on you. So right. It's a hierarchical form of individualism. And they're saying libertarian, they're saying individualism, but this is no longer within a liberal context. This is within authoritarian context. Mm-hmm. So it has different meanings.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to leave us with? This has been really helpful and informative. Anything else that you think we should know or pay attention to? And how should we pay attention to your work and follow your work?
So I'm sort of in the preliminary stages of my research, and right now I'm actually investigating InfoWars as a case study and Alex Jones as a sort of key figure of the far right. And the one point I want to make clear is that this is not going away. This is spreading very fast. If you go on InfoWars website right now, you are inundated with information that on every single topic, every single detail, you don't need to go to any other news source. And this is all happening now. It's even more hyper-partisan, it's even more extreme because it's off of YouTube. And so now it's all done within their own platform. And we need to start taking these people seriously. And one of the things that I've noticed, and maybe I'll get criticized for this, but I don't see much literature among political scientists, both conventional and heterodox, that have taken people like Alex Jones seriously. Mm-hmm. They've seen him always as this kind of loose cannon, conspiracy theorist, nutcase, fringe minority and whatnot, because you're not looking where you should be looking. And I think we should be looking at digital media, social media, where the mobilization's happening. And I would say that while we've ignored people like Alex Jones for so long, he was able to mobilize to the point where he had a conversation with Donald Trump, the president of the United States, and Trump told Alex Jones, I will not let you down. Mm-hmm. That is a very big leap in terms of influence between where he was in 2001 and in the late 90s to now. So we can't ignore these things. Yes, they're fringes. Yes, we can say it's only a small minority, whatnot, and the media is exaggerating, but I think we should take this as a very serious threat.
I live in Central Texas. I lived in Austin for years. So Alex Jones is a really important figure here. You'd see InfoWars bumper stickers on the backs of cars, you know, since I moved here in the early 2000s. But I agree that he's either dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously, but he has really galvanized a violent, vicious far-right street presence. There's the influence that he had up to the very highest levels of power, but here we organized November 4th, 2017 protests against the Trump-Pence regime. And Alex Jones and others actually put out a complete misinformation, a really vicious campaign that we were starting a civil war, even though what we were calling for was completely nonviolent protests. And, you know, in Austin, Alex Alex Jones wasn't there, but InfoWars people were there. We were surrounded by these armed, absolutely unhinged street thugs, and we powered through it. We stood strong, but it was sort of very much a precursor. And this was after Charlottesville, but you could see the seeds of what would become the January 6th riots. You know, I'm really interested in what you're researching about Alex Jones and InfoWars, and we'll have to have you back to talk about that. Is there anything else you want to leave us with? I don't know if you're on social media or any way that our listeners should follow your work.
I'm still in the sort of the beginning stages of my research, but I can see the gaps already in academic research. And I am on Twitter. I haven't been posting much because Twitter can get very vicious. But if people do want to follow me, I mean, it's called Restore the Real. I don't make too many comments just yet, but I may start because it just seems that there needs to be a voice about this. And it's been great talking, and anything I can do to help, I'd be happy to do so.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and good luck with your research. I think it's really important.
Thank you.
Now let's listen to the voices of three people who were involved in counter protests. First, you'll hear from Sam Hirsch, who is on the board of directors of Horizon Ottawa, a grassroots organization dedicated to creating a city that genuinely works for everyone. Then you'll hear from Ottawa resident Andrea Hardin. And finally, you'll hear the voice of David Chernyshenko, a former Ottawa City Councilman.
You know, in terms of what a lot of us here call occupation, when they first came here, almost close to 3 weeks now, I went for a walk with a friend of mine around the area. I mean, I live downtown, but I went a bit near Parliament Hill. You know, we went walking around, and the first 2 days, it was very clear to us what it was. It was very clear to us that it was a far-right occupation right off the bat. You could tell they were going to be there for a long time. They said they wouldn't leave because there had been a similar protest, actually, whatever you want to call it, demonstration in 2019. In Ottawa, when they came to Parliament Hill, they called it the United We Roll Convoy. And they did the same thing, except they left after a day. And we did have a counter protest to that. So folks were thinking of organizing something, but, you know, only found out a couple of days before they were coming in. So, you know, I was like, you know what, they'll probably just leave after a couple hours and that'll be that. But that's not what happened. There's multiple things in the way of causing harm. I mean, the most obvious is obviously, you know, people getting harassed in the streets, elderly people going to get groceries, queer folks. Folks in, you know, racialized folks, the Black, Indigenous, people of color, communities who feel threatened and unsafe to walk on the street. I'm Jewish myself, you know, seeing Nazi flags hanging from hotel balconies, the three percenter flags, as you know, right, the white supremacist group in the US for folks in Canada who don't know. Scary, right? The leaders of this convoy, this occupation, talk about violence every day. That bullets are coming. You know, a lot of the times, obviously taking with a grain of salt, I mean, when we had the blockading the convoy like we did on Sunday, they said they were bringing a lot of reinforcements, but only like 10 or 15 people came. So a lot of it are just like bully tactics and threats from them. But people who have pride flags in their windows, getting rocks thrown in their windows. I was physically threatened because I was wearing a mask. People don't feel safe. I was going to go to the grocery store yesterday because it was Valentine's Day. I wanted to have dinner with my partner, but we didn't feel comfortable going to the grocery store. Workers are being harassed every day, and their employers are not, in many cases, are not supporting or helping them because they want business. Hotels are letting these people stay there. One hotel in particular in Ottawa is housing Pat King, who is one of the leaders, far-right leaders of this group, who's inciting violence every day. And some of the more, I guess, non-obvious ways is that these trucks being on our streets every day, is there's a lot of smog in the air. The air quality is worse. And obviously, there's a little bit more obvious one where, you know, it's basically a big super spreader event. I mean, there's lots of people without masks, as I said, walking into stores to shop without masks, not listening to people. When grocery stores have had to close out of safety because when employees ask them to put on masks, they often get violent. The other day, on the Sunday, when I took a break from the blockade, I went into a Tim Hortons coffee shop here, and there was a couple that was part of the convoy not wearing their masks. And I turned to them and I said, you know, if you really support workers, if your movement is really working class movement, you'll put on your mask or you'll leave. And they kept arguing with me, and they eventually left. And the workers thanked us for doing that because, you know, a lot of these workers are afraid because they just want to be safe, like anyone does at their job. So, and obviously there's the honking as well, which is, there was a court injunction that stopped that for a bit, but it's basically like sound torture, right? There's a lot of people. I don't live right in that area, but I have a lot of friends who do. And for a long time, it was just 24 hours a day, just honking. And it's a form of torture. So there's lots of stuff, the physical, verbal harassment, the honking, the fumes in the streets, because they leave their trucks on idling They're blocking our whole downtown. And, you know, there's often threats of, you know, we don't know, but they probably have weapons as well. I mean, I know people who have seen eyewitness accounts. So they're basically terrorizing them. This isn't a movement in any sense of the word. This is, a large group of thugs, fascist thugs, right-wing extremists trying to scare people, using the issue of vaccine mandates as a ploy to further the right-wing agenda, which is to have an insurrection like what was happening in the United States. So when this began, community organizations like our own, like Horizon Ottawa and others came together and said, we need to do something. And that was this about 2 weeks ago on a Tuesday. We were like, we need to organize a counter rally. Let's do it. When we talked about it, there were a lot of safety concerns because, if you do this, the people that are most at risk, regardless if it's intended or not, will be the BIPOC community, will be people of color, racialized people who are going to be most at threat. So, we ended up calling it off and not doing it. And then there was another counter rally planned on the Saturday and canceled that one too. And after the first week, a lot of people were demoralized because people were scared and people were like, well, if we can't stand up in our community, like, what are we going to do? But eventually we came together and on the Saturday, we built up a robust safety plan that whole week and had a big march. It was organized really by residents, community organizations and labor unions in the city came together and were like, we have to do something. And we did. We made sure it was safe and nothing happened, but it was very positive. I mean, there were 4,000 of us on the streets and neighbors were clapping and cheering us on because, they have been going through this torture for the past 2+ weeks. And our local government here has done absolutely nothing. Federal and provincial government as well. Our mayor here in the city has made a deal, for example, with the convoy organizers to try and appease them. It's not what anyone wants. Our chief of police recently resigned today. Police have not treated this seriously because in many ways they're complicit in enabling this occupation of our city. So, the day after the Saturday, I was like, I'm just going to relax. It was a large rally to organize. And, I'm kind of tired and got this message saying like, 25 people about are going to blockade this intersection. Are you going to, can you get other people? Can you come? And I said, sure, I'll be there. It started in a group of a dog walking group. I think I went there, drove over there. There was about 30 people there at the start. I went there at around 9:15. It started at 9 a.m. Then it really grew exponentially from there. I posted online about it. A bunch of other people posted online about it. It just kept growing and growing. And, we blocked about 30 trucks and cars that were going through, that were trying to go through on an intersection here in Ottawa on a main road. And, at the beginning, it was, the police were there and the police made us move so that one of the trucks could get by, which was unfortunate. The police were making sure not to show any bias or anything like that when they were there with us, because I think they're under a lot of pressure. But, it was an immense show of community power and standing against, white supremacy and, standing up for our city, right? Because for a lot of us, it's very real. And, we're not watching this from, my parents live in Montreal, right? They're watching it. I'm from Montreal and other people in Toronto, they're watching this. And there have been convoys that have gone there, but it hasn't been nearly the same. It's very real to a lot of us. So it's really hard not to think about anything else other than this when you live downtown. And even when you live in the suburbs of the city, at times it was a very tense situation. The crowd was enthusiastic, but they had called in reinforcements to try to provoke people. And we basically, eventually made concessions with the trucks to move out slowly one by one if they promise not to go to downtown Ottawa and never come back to our city and to take off the hateful insignia off their car, which they did. And myself and a couple of others were involved in sort of like negotiating with them on the grounds that they'd leave. And who's to say we should trust them or not, but they genuinely sounded like they said, we're never coming back to Ottawa ever again. Just moving forward, I mean, it's been interesting to see, right, how quickly this has radicalized a lot of people on the left, I would say, in like a positive way. I mean, obviously there's like, bad sort of radicalization on the right, but a lot of people are like, really excited. What's next? What should we do next? And, I think that it's unfortunate, but I don't think that they're going to leave anytime soon. I mean, I hope that they do, obviously. But if you're in the US, I mean, if you could come help us out, come over here, join us in our next action that's taking place. I mean, they have people coming over from all over. So, I think, why can't we have cross-country international movement against these folks in our cities to run them out, because the police are not doing it. And obviously we want to be as safe as we can, but we also want to stand up for folks in our city and in our country and against the far right internationally and show that, these folks are not welcomed here in our city. Another thing, I guess, finally, is the conception of this being a working class movement, because I've been seeing this being covered right in the US and certain mainstream outlets. And that's the line that people are saying, or this is a trucker movement for truckers. I mean, that's not what it is, right? Like 90% of truckers are vaccinated. in Canada, the Teamsters Union in Canada condemned this as not part of them. So, I mean, it's really not right to use that term. This is the leaders of are not truckers. They're not workers. They're in many cases wealthy owners of their own business or anything like that, right? So in many cases, they're like the petty bourgeoisie. They're not working class people. I mean, I saw a couple of people at the convoy driving Lincolns. You know, that's just one thing for sure that I would, for people and, you know, across the country and internationally to think about, that this isn't a working class movement. And it's a movement to embolden the far right and force, you know, hateful ideas at the head of our government.
I consider myself sort of a social movement organizer of like 15 plus years. I've attended demonstrations here. I've organized demonstrations here. I've organized nonviolent civil disobedience training. I've done de-escalation techniques, but the way the convoy is being treated in downtown Ottawa is unlike anything I've ever seen. You know, I personally was asked to get off of Parliament Hill because I accidentally had a stick in a propped oil barrel at the time, and it was considered a weapon. If you look at the police response to G20 in Toronto and various anti-war marches we've had in Ottawa, very, very starkly different. So I think there are people here that already understand the reasons to defund the police or have various levels of questioning of the police. And I think there's a growing population of people basically saying, you know, what the hell is going on? This is unacceptable. How is this happening in our city? So I think there's various layers of what people are feeling at this moment. Certainly, I know people who live in Centretown, and what's happening there is absolutely unacceptable. People are being harassed for wearing a mask. People are ripping masks off their face. They're being spat at. They're being shoved and pushed. And worse, there was an attempted arson at an apartment building downtown, allegedly because of a interaction that happened between folks who were living there and were frustrated, and convoy folks who were blowing their air horns, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been a very tense moment overall living in Ottawa these past couple of weeks, I would say. So on Saturday in our city, there was a march that was held, and it was very well marshaled and planned. And it was around challenging, you know, the occupation that we were seeing and supporting healthcare workers and protecting each other in our communities and calling out the sort of harassment and worse we've been seeing. And that was in the thousands, and it stayed in a neighborhood that was sort of not right downtown. And I think that was very well received and kind of brought a comfort level for some people to get out in the streets and to be doing something. So I went to that with a number of neighbors and friends, and everybody walked away feeling empowered, but at the same time feeling like we need to do something to kind of, you know, challenge this more directly. And, you know, I woke up the next morning thinking I was going to bring my kiddo to basketball class, but here are my neighbors on a text loop saying, did you see this post in our Being Neighborly Facebook group that is usually for like lost mittens and dog walks and this kind of stuff, saying the convoy is going to drive right past our neighborhood. And instantly everybody was just like, we got to go. So this process of like street level organizing happened, where the dads took care of the childcare and the dogs. And then five moms from my street, including me, went out to this intersection where we knew they were coming. We met up with, I think we were a total of 33 people. And I showed up and I was just asking, you know, has anybody ever done anything like this? And there, it was all shaking heads. No. So I said, okay, if you're okay with me helping, here's some ideas. And so we landed on, you know, we were going to walk around the intersection with our signs once we saw the trucks pull up with the flags and various other things that were part of this convoy coming from this like parking lot where they're housed themselves, to join downtown. And we kind of did a round of names. Who are you? What street are you on? Why do you want to be here? It was all folks who live in our neighborhood. And then we did exactly what we said we would. So we saw the trucks coming from the background. And I should mention at this point, actually, our local city councilor joined us and our local MPP joined us, both community members living in the neighborhood and supporters of resistance to this convoy of what's been happening. So we instantly took the intersection, and then there was this process of needing to make space to allow some of the cars that were clearly not convoy related and were in the wrong place at the wrong time, mm-hmm. Through. And in the process of doing that, you know, there were several trucks that tried to jump into the lane and get through. And before I knew it, I found myself throwing my back against the hood of one of these trucks and having it sort of slowly push me towards the car in front, thinking just, you know, we're here to stop this convoy and we're going to stop this convoy. But also, I don't want any truck to be able to pick up speed because I don't want to see anybody hurt. And of course, I think like five people came and joined me within an instant, within a second. And by the way, that truck got stuck there for 7 hours for the entire day. There was no moving for that truck. You know, those of us who were there were instantly, you know, on social media, sharing, come down, help. And it blossomed just within a matter of, I don't know, minutes, hours. But we were there the entire day, hundreds of people, probably over 1,000, frankly. We essentially locked in about 30 trucks. We corralled them from the front and from the back. And we're walking back and forth the entire day, having community consultations and circles with each other. What's the end game? How do we handle this? What comes next? And it was messy. There was different opinions. There was excitement. There was frustration and overwhelming anger at the fact that we're here and doing this and the police are not, and varying levels of degree of trust in the police. But it was kind of beautiful, organized chaos. Mm-hmm. And in the end, nobody got hurt. And we held them the entire day, not the police, we did, until we negotiated, and again, not the police, people negotiated that the truckers would be allowed to leave if they surrendered their jerry cans of diesel, which several had, and any sort of propaganda that they have in the car. And by and large, all of the truckers did exactly that. I personally put my efforts to using my de-escalation techniques that I've sort of been trained in the past years ago. So basically, we had a couple of, I believe, outside convoy folks come to, I guess, see what was happening. There was a call out from Pat King, in fact, one of the so-called leaders over TikTok, for people to show up and support fellow convoy folks. So there were several of these convoy folks who came unmasked, were doing their TikTok, you know, filming or whatever, I assume, because they're on their phone. And essentially, in my opinion, what they were trying to do is provoke a response out of folks who were there. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that did happen. There's a lot of anger boiling over and there was tense interactions. And I have a new favorite de-escalation tool, and it's called a cowbell. My neighbor brought it. And anytime interactions became too heated, or if they started spouting hate or conspiracy theories, I just stood in their general area and rang that cowbell. And let me tell you, I don't think anybody was hearing what was going on over social media when that cowbell was going off. So that was an interesting lesson right there. But my goal was to try to de-escalate situations so that we didn't find ourselves in a space where people were throwing punches, because I didn't think that that would be helpful for the movement at large and for what we're saying and the stand that we were taking. And I believe the majority of people there would agree with that position. And that wasn't just me doing it. People organically, whenever there was sort of an escalation happening amongst either ourselves or with convoy participants or with police, because that happened too, there were folks who just kind of immediately, naturally just kind of went around and had these conversations. What is our goal? What are we doing here? Is this what we really want? Don't let them become the martyr that they want to be. You know, make sure you have folks on the ground, if you can, that are well-skilled in de-escalation techniques and are ready and able to use them, and do the community consultations on the fly, get a bullhorn, form a circle, talk to people, have conversations, like keep that going. But also remember to keep the positive reasons why people are there too. I think that was a key lesson for me too, is when we're talking to each other, let's remember that if we hold them for an hour or if we hold them for 24 hours, you know, this is a win. They are not getting where they want to be.
I live in a world where you do not expect anyone to engage in protest or political action with a violent side to it, or even a bullying side to it. Because looking at words carefully here, we have seen very little overt violence in the sense of someone being hit. There haven't been any weapons seen. But let's look at that again more carefully. What we have seen is very large trucks 18-wheelers by the many dozens, perhaps hundreds, allowed to come right up to Parliament. So, you know, right up to your state capitol or the White House or, you know, or Congress, practically to its doorsteps and set up camp and not move for going on 3 weeks now. We saw it coming because this was broadcast weeks in advance that this trucker convoy, ostensibly to protest the vaccine mandate that if you wanted to be a trucker crossing the border between Canada and the US, you had to be vaccinated. Well, guess what? That is equally an American mandate as well as a Canadian one. We have both agreed that to reduce the spread of disease, to be a professional trucker, you had to be vaccinated, double vaccinated in order to make that move. Well over 90% of Canadian professional truckers abide by that, agree with it. The truckers' unions do, the major companies do, they support that. To the extent that the average person and the media could know what we were really looking at was actually a very disenchanted, angry group of almost entirely white right-wing groups that have engaged in a host of over-the-top rhetoric and rabble-rousing over a couple of years, collecting as they went various neo-Nazis, supremacists, and others, building social media networks. But in as much as any of this thing is well organized, because on the one hand, it's the absolute Keystone Cops. It's a gong show. It's a crazy bunch of disparate people with no organization whatsoever. On the other hand, they've managed to pull together fairly substantial numbers of trucks to come into the capital city. We were astounded that our law enforcement decided to let them right up to Parliament, to the core of the city, and effectively pull the trucks up, put the brakes on, some of them take the wheels off, and start setting up camps with every imaginable bit of a sort of a village brought in with them. This has never been allowed before. Only so-called truckers have ever been allowed to come with their vehicles right up to the center. The other thing that was very surprising, on one hand, not so much afterwards, was the 10 to 20,000 or so average citizens who came to support this because for various reasons, they saw it as Canadians standing up against big government, COVID measures, overreach, no one's got the right to stick something in my body, et cetera. A host of grievances and the people wanting to, you know, outwardly average mom and pop and the kids coming up for a big rally and a party. But the naivete to not know who they were actually providing cover for. Mom and pop and the kids are here for a protest, but they're providing cover to a siege. And where it becomes violent is we have roaming groups of typically burly men and pickup trucks roaming the streets, shouting at people, hey, mask boy, what are you afraid of? Take off the mask or I'm going to rip it off you. Intimidating everyone. Just so happens that Ottawa's gay village is very close to where they first set up. Intimidating anyone with the rainbow flag, anyone who they thought looked like they were gay. And on the list I can go. Restaurants where two people walk in with no masks and say, I want to eat. And they're told, we'd love to have you eat. Are you going to wear masks? And can I see your vaccine QR code? I have a right. I have a right to be in here. Is the owner? And then out it comes. Is the owner, and I'll pick a random country name just to show you what this is like, but I don't want to identify the establishments. Is the owner Indonesian? Okay, what does that mean? Well, I guess it means that if the owner is Indonesian, they're somehow inferior and are being targeted. We were all told this has the potential to get violent. Please stay at home. Do not engage in counter protests. So like good Canadians, we sat on our hands and did nothing and fumed and vented on Facebook and Twitter. But it built and built and built. And finally, when very literally here, 10 or so dog walkers on a Facebook group, women, saw that a route of the convoy from where they've set up camp at baseball stadium parking lot to drive through the city and do a slow roll, as in we were going to have them on our residential streets, that it was coming very close to us. They decided spontaneously on a Saturday night, we're going to go and we're going to be at that corner and block it. And so I woke up on a Sunday morning, 9:30, 10 o'clock, went online and whoa, you know, we're here holding the line with 15 or 20 trucks blocked. We need help. So like a good brave man, I said to my wife and 20-ish daughter, hey, who's with me? And we all agreed that we wanted to be there in solidarity with our neighbors and as a way to finally express just how angry we are with these people and with our own authorities for their incompetence to date of really cracking down on them. We took great pains while there to make sure that it was all kept peaceful. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, the largest number of police I've seen in many, many weeks showed up as so-called liaison interveners. Now, I know many good police officers in this city, and I've worked with them. I do not understand what the strategy is, if there is one, but what it looks like to the outsider is because these people are white, ostensibly truckers, and look maybe like most of you, you're going to treat them very differently than an Aboriginal pipeline protest or a G20 summit march, where you wade in with truncheons with your shields and your full battle armor and sick the dogs on them. So that it all did come off peacefully and made its point has ended up becoming a symbol in the city, nationally, and even internationally.
Oh, yeah.
People saying, so glad to see you do this. We were worried. We started to think, you know, didn't know what to think. Canadians engaged in this kind of a thing? A, yes, some Canadians are, but B, most of us don't support it. Well, when we first arrived, it was minus 20 with the howling wind. So, you know, you got the call to rush out and help your neighbors. That required at least 15 minutes of putting on the right clothing. So once we got on all the cold weather gear, knowing we might be there for a while, and marched, in our case, the, you know, the 10 minutes to get there and cross the bridge, there was that moment of trepidation. Mm-hmm. I've never been involved in counter-protest, in facing off against another group. I didn't know what to expect. And frankly, I didn't know if I'd have the nerve if it looked like we were outnumbered and something nasty was going down. Mm-hmm. It was clear there was the critical mass that I and, you know, my family could walk in and say, we're here, we're going to stand here, start to figure out who's doing what. Is there an organization going on here? And when we came back for another 3 hours in the afternoon, it had swelled from that 100 or so to 1,000 or so. And food was arriving. And this was fascinating. Just as we saw the original occupation siege in downtown, getting food from supporters, within minutes, people were arriving with boxes of donuts and hot chocolate. And on Twitter, people in Toronto, you know, 5 hours away, were saying, just had 10 pizzas are on their way to you. But what I got that night and over the next couple of days from Canadians everywhere was, we are so happy to see that people are standing up to this, because we didn't know what to make of it in the end.
A couple of things struck me as I was listening to these compelling stories. First, Ottawa residents have endured for the last several weeks, not just a little inconvenience and noise pollution. They have indeed been under siege by a fascist movement with global reach that is tearing up the world as they know it, emboldening and reinforcing each other every day that they are not stopped, and signaling that they are determined to be the future of Canada. Of course, fascists around the world are celebrating this. Second, that there was contention and disagreement about taking action to resist this siege, with the standard excuses that standing up to these bullies will bring revenge against the marginalized communities of people of color or LGBT people, or that standing up to them will cause violent clashes that will further feed the right-wing talking points. But look at how the terms changed once the decent people stepped out in a public show of resistance. What is most dangerous to marginalized communities, and what will ultimately bring the most violence to humanity? Counter-protesting now to stop these convoys, or allowing a fascist movement to grow and metastasize and take hold over every institution in society? It is really that simple. And the people of Ottawa showed how it can be done so that the people on the side of justice maintain their discipline and are not provoked. Ultimately, fascism has to be stopped by the people. And this cannot be done from the sidelines or the so-called comfort of our safe spaces. No place is safe from fascism, which is one possible resolution to deep crises that every nation in the world faces under the system we live under, a worldwide system of capitalism imperialism. We will continue to bring out the various dimensions of this in future episodes. Thanks for listening to the Refuse Fascism podcast. We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at @Coco_Doss or our regular host at Sam B. Goldman. Or you can drop her a line at SamanthaGoldman@RefuseFascism.org. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can donate by visiting RefuseFascism.org and hitting the donate button. Venmo, Refuse-Fascism. Cash App, Refuse-Fascism. Thanks to Sam Goldman, Richie Marini, and Lena Thorne for helping produce this episode. And thanks to our incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.